Well, now, what about the future? I know you suggest that we're always behind ourselves in realizing what's going on.
We're always living a way ahead of our thinking, yes.
Welcome to The Pub Call, episode 16 for the first 2 weeks of August 2009. The Pub Call is the netcast where we talk about the future of book publishing. On the call this week is Cassia Crozier from BookSquare and Richard Nash from Cursor. Why don't you guys say hello?
Hello.
Hey there.
Cool. Kat Meyer is taking a break this week, but we have two special guests. Kirk Biglioni is one of the founding quarters of Quartet Press, and he is a blogger at MediaLoper.com. Welcome, Kirk.
Hey. Glad to be here.
Also joining us is Andrew Savikas. Andrew is the Vice President of Digital Initiatives at O'Reilly Media and the Program Chair of the Tools of Change Conference. Andrew, you're in Boston, correct?
That's right.
Welcome.
Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, welcome. Thanks so much. So off the top, we are going to talk about Sony. For topic two, we are going to talk about the one-day digital conference O'Reilly is planning for Frankfurt. For topic three, we will talk about books as apps on the iPhone and elsewhere. I haven't talked to you guys for 2 weeks, and you all go off and plan panels for South by Southwest. What the heck's going on there? Richard, why don't you tell us about your panel?
It was actually, funnily enough, I wasn't entirely responsible for either one. There's a woman who has a blog called The Tomorrow Museum, who was interested in doing something on basically the non-networked novel, the kind of, you know, quiet, immersive process of sort of disappearing reading. I don't mean disappearing that it's vanishing, but disappearing into a text kind of reading. And she wanted to do something on that topic for South by Southwest, and she asked me if she could do it in my name. So I was like, sure, no problem. So I think a very good young adult editor by the name of David Levithan, who's the publisher of the hip kid imprint at Scholastic, the Push imprint, is also going to be on it. And he's also a very good young adult novelist himself. I think his primary claim to fame as a writer is he's the co-author of Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist. And then the other one is really Kevin Smokler's panel that is in effect a kind of a sorry about last year, we'll do better this time kind of South by Southwest panel, which I think Kazia is on too, and Jeff Soroy, who's the SVP of marketing and publicity at Farrar Straus, and somebody from HarperCollins, although I can't figure out exactly who.
I think it's Debbie Steer.
Okay. At one point he had Sarah Burningham written down, but she resigned yesterday. So
yeah,
he tells me she's not going. So Debbie's going to do it.
Yeah, it's Debbie.
And Cassia, you guys have other things in the works? What about those?
Well, the lovely Mr. Hugh McGuire contacted me earlier today and said, hey, we've got this panel that we've thrown together. Do you want to be part of it? We've got Andrew Savikas and Peter Brantley. And I'm like, okay, I guess I can compete.
You have me at hello, right?
It's like, yeah, I'll give it my best shot, but, you know, I'm going to be the intellectual lightweight on this panel. And Kevin's panel, Hugh McGuire's, which we're all pimping quite effectively. Richards, Dominique Rocca, and Michael Cater also proposed Dinosaurs Dancing, Digital Experiments from Traditional Book Publishers. So I think there are a good 20 or so possible panels out there right now.
And, you know, I was looking at your blog post, and I was like, you know, Greenleaf, I guess Greenleaf's in Austin, right? Like, they should just host all the panels that don't get accepted and have, like, a little impromptu shadow conference just so we can have, like, the whole book cabal of it down there. Like, some great, great, great panels with some great people on it, too.
That's a great idea. If you'd like, I'm happy to get in touch with Clint and see if he's up for it.
Well, it just seemed like, you know, like there was kind of the absence of participation for a couple of years running, like you noted, Cassia, and then all of a sudden this year it's like everyone's all in, and it just seems like an embarrassment of riches on that list.
Yeah, I'm pretty happy about that. And yeah, I know somebody at Greenleaf too, so he's already looking on places where we can meet for drinks. So I think if we can get Greenleaf involved.
First things first.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I guess like you know, you make your pitch, and then if you get accepted, then you can kind of justify the expense to your company, right? And so I'm sure a lot of those people.
What company?
Well, I'm sure
we are the company.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure what words these words you use, but yeah, I'm very excited about this because I think. It's a different kind of energy. I don't know if anybody other than Kirk's ever been to South by Southwest, but it's really an optimistic, energetic kind of, everybody there is more about, okay, problem, how do we solve it? Not problem, put our head in our hands. And so you tend to walk away thinking, okay, I can do this, whatever this is.
Well, and you know, historically it's been kind of this emergent conference, you know, these little kind of sub-conferences spring up now and then, and some of them become part of the official conference, like Screenburn for video games. And then some of them aren't really part of the official conference, but they're just kind of out there on the fringes. So I think, you know, if there really is this much interest in people in the publishing business going to Austin in March, which is a great thing to do, it would be great to see it kind of spin off into something a little bigger.
Yeah, well, we've got lots of conferences on the calendar, as we'll get to a little bit later. But let's handle Sony off the top, I guess. As I was reviewing the news from the last 2 weeks, you know, Sony just popped up over and over again. And, you know, they have two new readers with speculation of a third with wireless on the way. They announced they're going 100% EPUB, and then just today I saw that they have a new PSP on the way, and it looks like that might have ebook support. So I'm loving that they're being like super agile, but you know, they're number two in the market. They have no real ties to the industry other than as a device maker. So I'm kind of seeing this as really they have no choice. So Kirk, as in your eyes, is any of this activity worrying Amazon? Like, what does this mean for the rest of the sector? All this churn.
I can't see anything worrying Amazon, let alone two new readers from Sony that don't have wireless. That are really, I mean, even the model numbers are a step down from what was currently on the market. Although, if they really are announcing wireless in a week or any time this summer, that would explain why these two new devices really seem to be more positioned towards getting something out there that's cheaper and more affordable. But Amazon, no. You know, the true test is going to be when they release a wireless device, seeing how fully integrated the purchasing process is. They need to nail that kind of seamless delivery of content that Amazon has mastered. And until someone does that, Amazon really doesn't have much to fear.
Richard, do you think that we've talked about the magic price point for a reader before, even under 200? Do you think does that move the needle for the customer at all?
You know, you bump up with me against my inability to conceive of such a thing as a standalone reader. I just can't handle it. I have a hard time kind of being able to
parse out. There is a distinction. I don't wish to say there's not a distinction. You're right, there's a distinction. I just have a hard time figuring out how much it matters whether they're going to be able to sell another 50,000 units or 100,000 units when the device is ultimately, heading to the scrap heap.
Cassio, what about the EPUB thing? Like, does this, we see this pattern over and over again where kind of the second place person in the market embraces open standards. They're all about open. Do customers care at this point?
Last year, I quoted a reader who said she could care less at this point what publishers did as long as they all settled on one thing. You've got people who are so tired of dealing with it. They don't really care one way or the other. They just want a solution. But Sony's not really as open because they're still going to be wrapping their books in the Adobe DRM. And
what we're hearing is they're requiring the DRM. It's not even optional for publishers.
Yes, that's true.
And at least Amazon makes it optional.
Yes, that's true. And that's something that we've struggled. We've really had some conversations with Sony, and I can't get into too much detail. But that's really the reason that our titles aren't part of the Sony store is that currently, their position is that it's really somewhat of a technical issue and somewhat of a business decision, but they don't currently give a publisher the option to not use the DRM encryption. And that's, I think, will continue to be a challenge for them to marry the position of we're openly supporting EPUB, yet at the same time insisting on something that really goes counter to the whole reason to have an open standard format.
Yeah, I think I saw something earlier where they had wrapped DRM around some public domain titles and said that they had done it for copyright protection or something like that. That was a post that flew by me this week.
Barnes & Noble.
I think that might have been B&A. No.
Andrew, you guys are handling EPUB. You've got EPUB in your workflow. The fact that Sony is doing this doesn't really change how O'Reilly operates behind the scenes, does it? You guys are going to just continue doing what you're doing.
That's absolutely right. I mean, we obviously want to use and work with EPUB whenever we can with a new new channel. PDF I think is okay as well. People are showing that's still a valuable format for them. But for us, it doesn't really change anything. We're doing, for most of our books, we're doing EPUB and PDF and Mobi Pocket for Kindle. So, that's going to continue.
And what's the feeling about BNN here? Are they going to quickly roll over Sony if Sony doesn't get this right in the next 6 months?
This is probably something I may be skipping ahead on the agenda here, but for me, I think a lot of the attention and energy that's going toward sort of trying to handicap the race here on ebooks is premature and is ignoring the impact that smartphones already have and will continue to have here. I mean, the fact is the installed base for iPhone is already an order of magnitude bigger than all of the ebook devices combined, and that gap's going to grow when you look at probably 12 to 18 months from now. There's going to be some estimates as many Android devices out there as there are iPhones, and that I think the sheer numbers involved there just mean that is going to be a much larger market for content, whether that books or other things. And that's where we're paying a lot of attention and putting a lot of energy. And I think irrespective of how the sort of horse race turns out among Barnes & Noble and Sony and Kindle, the real action for paid books and related content is going to be on smartphones.
Right on. So just before we move on, O'Malley had come out and said, the big win in all of this is for Adobe, And Adobe's kind of been fighting the good fight behind the scenes to get their media server and their DRM to be kind of the industry standard. And Ohm pointed out that this looks like they've succeeded. Kirk, I don't know if you've been following the media server backend stuff at all. I don't know if you have anything to comment on before we move on, but...
Well, I saw that post on GigaOhm, and you know, my response to that is having the largest number of devices supported does not translate necessarily into winning the game. It could be that Adobe DRM is the plays for sure of ebooks. Microsoft licensed plays for sure to every device manufacturer who wanted it and then ended up abandoning it and releasing the Zune and Apple One on DRM. At least to the point where the labels finally gave in and went DRM free. So I don't see that Adobe licensing their DRM widely translates to market dominance.
Okay, so from kind of the digital publishing area to the industry as a whole, tools of change. Andrew, you guys are thinking. I'm wondering what you guys were thinking bringing TOC to Frankfurt.
That's a great question. but it's an important one. You know, so this year we sold out again in New York, and this is in an environment when we saw both in our conferences and conferences in general, you know, the economy really had a negative impact on the event business. And that's one of the first things that companies and individuals cut from their budget is travel and training and conferences. And so the continued strong response, you know, really said this is something people care about. And we know that we're getting a lot of attendance from Europe and from all over the world, but a lot specifically in Europe. And, you know, just as we have previously brought things like the Open Source Convention and Web 2.0 to other areas, Europe, especially, but also places like Beijing and Tokyo, you know, just wanting to see, is there an appetite for this kind of conversation in Europe specifically, and maybe, who knows, in the future somewhere else. And so the Frankfurt connection is, you know, sort of twofold. One is, hey, everyone's, you know, already there. And so, you know, we can sort of draft, you know, ride in their you know, draft their sales there. And the other one is, you know, we specifically look to do something with the Frankfurt Book Fair because they know the European audience and they have a lot of connections with the kind of associations and groups that we really need to reach out to get a good program together and get a lot of attendees. And so, you know, I think it was a way for us to test the waters of, you know, putting together an event like this in Europe and see what the response is. And so far it's been really good. And my hope is that, you know, longer term, we can either repeat something like this or maybe do something larger. So, you know, it's been a really great way to test the waters and see what the response is in an area that, while we are somewhat known, you know, we don't have as much experience reaching out to a European audience as we do here in the States.
So from as a program chair, are you approaching this differently? Is there, you know, a European spin, any different topics, any different people, or are you just trying to grow the audience?
Yeah, it's a mix. So some of it was going to say what really worked well in New York and what are the things we covered there that are going to matter to a European audience, and so sort of bringing some of that over, and then also finding stuff that's really unique to a European audience that talks about some of their issues. So from my perspective, it was a little more, you know, there's a little less time to work on it and a smaller number of slots to fill. So a lot of it was kind of, you know, I did a lot more directly myself than I would for the larger event, but I'm really thrilled with how it's turning out. And you know, I think it's going to be a really strong program. And I don't wish I had something. I mean, some of the speakers are listed on the site, but I don't have the full program in a position that I can put it out there just yet.
So TOC 2010 is on the calendar in New York for February, end of February still?
That's right.
Do you want to put in a quick plug as to where you are with that?
Yeah, absolutely. So right now where we're at is we're looking for suggestions for sessions and panels and keynotes for the conference, and that's through the end of this month. We're going to be accepting those. The website is toccon.com. There's a link there to submit a proposal. And we're also accepting proposals for what in the past we've called lightning demos, but really are, you know, more properly the Pecha Kucha sort of short form content that I think in the past we put that during one of the evenings and didn't get as much attendance as I think the content deserved. And so we're going to integrate that more into the program. And that's typically a really popular part of the program.
Oh, that's awesome. So a little 15 minutes of fame for someone that can put together a PowerPoint presentation.
Exactly, exactly. And that's actually going to be something that we're doing in Frankfurt as well. To just because it's such a great format for people who may not have the name recognition or have a ton of stuff to fill an hour, typically it gives them a motivation to put something really interesting together.
If I could add just to Andrew's description of the Frankfurt event, I've been going to Frankfurt on the rights and distribution side of things for since 2001, and the programming there has been fairly limited. It's been a fair really driven by just the fact of its number one status as a place to meet. It's a fair driven by 16 half-hour meetings a day, and it's not been a place where you can step back and learn. So it's rather cool that Jürgen and O'Reilly have joined up there. It's also a fair that hadn't really done anything outside of its 5 days of the year, and they've now launched a newsletter, Publishing Perspectives, that takes quite an international perspective and is quite focused on trying to talk about the future of publishing globally. Andrew did a great piece for there a couple of weeks ago. It's the Frankfurt Book Fair really kind of stepping forward a whole, almost an order of magnitude, really, into the new publishing universe. So it's exciting.
And those Publishing Perspective guys are in New York, are they not?
Well, yes and no, actually. Ed Novotka, who was formerly Publishers Weekly, who's the editor-in-chief, is based in Austin. No, he's based in Dallas. And
one of those cities.
And Hannah Johnson was at the German Book Office in New York, but she's actually moving to Frankfurt, although she's going to continue working on the newsletter, and I think she's working on Tools to Change Frankfurt itself. Right, Andrew?
Yes, that's right.
That's cool. So Frankfurt is happening in the middle of October, and Tools of Change is going the day before the show goes up, right? So
that's right. It's Tuesday, October 13th, and it's at tocfrankfurt.com. And you can see a list of the speakers, and we'll have a full agenda up there pretty soon.
Cool. Okay, so let's move on to the app economy. Ebooks on the iPhone kind of seem like a no-brainer. There's a real opportunity to make money. DRM is less of an issue. Cassia is dealing with iTunes an afterthought for most publishers. Are they dropping the ball on this? Or is that just...
Are most publishers dropping... most publishers are dropping the ball. And part of it is not everyone the reaction in the traditional industry, and I'm talking... not O'Reilly. I always feel like I carve O'Reilly out on every topic, every time we talk about this, is that there's this sense that, air quotes, nobody wants to read on the iPhone. And I found it interesting that Nathan Bransford from Curtis Brown had a post today talking about how he's become a true believer in reading on the iPhone. It's sort of the situation where readers are discovering this on their own, and they're finding it to be a really great experience, and they're really enjoying it. The content is not as easily found as it could be. We still have to jump through so many hoops. if and when Apple actually says, hey, yeah, we want to sell ebooks because we want to deal with the publishing industry, that sounds like fun, then it might be a little easier to bring everything together. But right now there's Barnes & Noble, there's Kindle, there's Stanza, there's this app, there's that app, and it's a little bit complex for readers to figure out where they go to find books. And, you know, Squirrel Motion's doing this thing, and so what we're kind of waiting for in a way is like the killer reader experience, I think. And I don't know how or when that's going to happen, but the readers are absolutely finding this to be a great alternative for them.
But okay, so you guys have just, you know, you're just starting your house, and you have the opportunity to kind of go direct to consumer, or as direct to consumer as you can. Is it more attractive for Quartet to deal with Apple, or is it more attractive for Quartet to deal with Scroll Motion, who then deals with Apple?
From my perspective, going direct to Apple makes more sense. Having our own app, et cetera, would make more sense. I don't believe that's the direction we're going, and I'm going to defer to Kirk on that.
You know, it really, I think it depends on the book. It depends on the publisher. It depends on what you're going to do. We're talking about kind of the, I guess, platonic ideal of the perfect book, which is everyone has a different ideal of what that is in their mind. But there are all different kinds of books, and different kinds of books require different kinds of apps. If you're talking about just a straight reading app, this deal with Stanza, with Lexical, for as long as Amazon allows them to do it, is a pretty great deal. I know O'Reilly is doing a lot of titles that way. You can easily get your books on there and on the in the App Store with really probably the best reading experience on the iPhone currently. I can't see why you would go through Scroll Motion. Other kinds of books are going to require different kinds of development, and they will produce apps that maybe don't even look like books. I mean, you look in the App Store for things that there are many, many examples of apps that used to be books, travel guides, restaurant guides. There's just, you know, there are all kinds of categories where things that were once books are going to be replaced by apps, and that becomes a little bit more challenging for publishers. It's not a straight transition from your print edition to an app version, and then it's not necessarily dealing with Apple. You have to deal with some other developer who's going to help you turn that into an application, and that would be an equivalent of something like Scroll Motion, although they're currently just doing the straight translation of traditional long-form reading.
So one of the criticisms, I guess, is well, there's been lots of criticisms of the App Store recently, I guess, and you know, one of the things is that it's just another kind of Kindle type of lock-in, and that makes me wonder if this has legs beyond, you know, beyond a couple of years, right? Like we had a pretty vibrant app economy with the Palm, the handheld device that just kind of went away. Are we looking at the kind of same thing with iTunes?
Well, this is where the Android is interesting, because it's going to run on more devices, and presumably any app economy is going to be more open. It'll be interesting to see how that develops.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a piece of the you know, the pricing is always an issue with apps, and I think that's one reason why there's such a downward pressure on prices there, because, you know, I think people know that this is a phone and they're used to, you know, changing phones out every year or two, and they don't really expect that what they buy on their phone is something that they're going to you know, be using 2 or 3 or 5 or 10 years from now. On the other hand, I mean, that's another place where, you know, something that we do with our apps is we make sure that it is possible to get at the content if you want to get it off of that app and you want to back it up and you want to move it to a different device, because I think that is going to be important to give readers the confidence to know that if their phone breaks, or if the Palm 3 turns out to be this great phone they want to switch to, that they have some options for not losing all of that for what they've invested in their apps. But I think the point earlier that about things that are not just app versions of print books is a really important one. I mean, that's one way to go, and you know, text is a fine way to communicate. We're all texting all the time on Twitter, and text is what is the basis of most of our social, you know, emails and social networks and that sort of thing. But there, you know, there's a huge opportunity to look at things differently and say, you know, this is a device that has, you know, that has eyes and ears and a mouth, and can interact with the world. And you know, one of my favorites is an app called Bird by Bird. So a bird watching app that you sort of hold the phone up and it listens for the bird call and can tell you what that is. I mean, that would have been this nice little pocket guide to birds of North America, you know, 5 or 10 years ago. And that's not what they did. They really went and said, this is a new platform. This is a new environment. This is a new medium. How do we accomplish that same job of helping people know what birds they're looking at in a way that takes advantage of this device and its native capabilities?
Richard, you from you bring kind of the social context to the future book experience. Is the App Store appealing in that area? Do you really see the iTunes platform being useful for the kind of things that you have in mind for the future of the book?
Well, I suppose. You know, there's a couple of different answers because it is a little premature, really, for me to be able to figure out how several different things need to happen. I mean, the obvious candidate for a maximal community around books is going to be books in the cloud. And as currently constructed, relatively few apps allow for much participation. But is it possible to conceive of apps that not only take the advantages of all the text in the cloud, but add geolocation to it and add what are intrinsically communications devices to it? Sure. I mean, it becomes, as has been, I think, discussed in a couple of listservs recently, the opportunity to sort of be reading a given book on your phone in a bar and to signal to readers who might be in the bar and are also single and are looking for someone to buy a drink to use the topic of one's reading as a kind of a plumage as a social signal is you know, enormous. I expect eventually, yes, that apps will be exceptionally useful in terms of allowing people to connect over books. Although in the short run, I see that happening more in the cloud than from downloadable applications.
Two questions for Andrew. You mentioned pricing a couple times, and you were doing some experimentation with pricing the last time I really heard you talk about this last February. Is the pricing kind of experimentation over? Have you pretty much found the sweet spot, or is that still an open question?
No, I mean, it's actually sort of just, it's really just beginning. You know, now we're getting to the point where we have, you know, enough variety of titles that we have an opportunity to do some real deliberate sort of formal pricing experiments. And fortunately, we have some really smart research folks to help us construct those experiments, but it's still way too early to feel like we've settled on something. But it is certainly true that this is an extremely price-sensitive market. You know, you have to remember that this is not a place where most people go to browse and buy books. It's really a place where they're browsing and buying apps, and that has a lot of the competition is, you know, 99-cent games and free content and music and movies and a lot of things that are not people aren't judging it based on their experiences and expectations from books on the shelf. They're basing it on experiences and expectations for the other, 69,999 apps that are in there. So it's still really early. The one thing I wish that we had a little more ability to do is to do different pricing in different regions of the world, because you sort of set a tier and then you're sort of stuck with that kind of price worldwide. And I understand that makes sense for Apple, but realistically, we're still very early, and you know, close observers of our apps will you know, careful readers will notice that the pricing does fluctuate to some extent, and that is absolutely intentional. while we gather some data. And we're probably going to do, well, I should say probably, we are doing something similar with some of our other channels, especially our direct sales, because that's something we have a lot of control over and ability to measure, is to see what some of that, what those demand curves look like. And, you know, I know the reflex is to say, you know, that kind of pricing scares the heck out of me to look at something at $4.99 or $9.99 or $14.99. But the reality is, if we can achieve as much or more revenue or profit with a higher volume at that lower price, then, you know, both us and the authors come out ahead. So our goal is always to find the sweet spot where we can generate the most sales, because that helps us and it helps our authors. But it's, you know, the experimentation is just begun.
And obviously there's the opportunity for subscription content that no one's really taken advantage of that I know of yet.
Yeah, that's right. One of the things that I'm hearing from app developers is that part of the challenge is a lot of people who, you know, yes, the iPhone is the big action right now, but you know, BlackBerry still has a huge subscriber base. Android is gaining a lot of traction. You know, Palm Pre's got a lot of excitement. And so if you want to develop an app that has a consistent experience and consistent pricing model, you know, right now, iPhone's the only one that has that kind of subscription option. So you can't really have one thing on the iPhone and have that same experience on BlackBerry right now. So I think you're seeing a lot of hesitation to push the envelope too far in terms of the pricing models, because they're just so hard to replicate in some of the other platforms.
Kirk, Cassie a couple weeks ago told me that I should ask you about book-related internet applications for the desktop. Is there a future for those?
Book-related internet applications for the desktop. Well, it's still, I think, the most popular e-reading platform is the computer, the full-on PC or Mac or whatever it is. Yeah, I think there is a future for those. Although, you know, mobile devices, as they become more widespread, you know, this whole new category, which we keep hearing rumors about with tablet-type devices, I think probably we're going to see reading move away from the desktop. Reading is a mobile experience, ultimately, I think.
Absolutely. I completely agree. And that's being, you know, that's showing up in our data. I mean, I if you sort of read the fine print in that post I did last week about our app sales, especially internationally, you know, we've got several of those titles now where we're selling more as apps than print units in BookScan. And I mean, that, you know, for us, very quickly for these titles, this is becoming far and away the place where more people are reading them electronically, and in some cases overall, compared with desktop apps or Kindle or Sony or, you know, other places like that.
I would imagine, though, for you, some of that may depend on the title. It seems like some hardcore reference manuals are still going to be something that your audience wants to read at their PC rather than looking up some kind of function reference on their phone.
That's a good point. Although, you know, for us, the challenge there is people, you know, no longer buy a reference manual when they can just Google the error they're getting. Yep. That said, our hypothesis was definitely that books that were more long-form narrative trade style would be popular as apps. But it's turned out that our sort of really core programming books are some of the best sellers, and people are actually very interested in that kind of content. Not as much reference, but more of sort of learning and you know, developing knowledge about a language or a framework or a platform. Those are doing really well. So that was a surprise.
Okay, so let's move on to bookmarks.
Is it that time already? Wow.
We're 40 minutes in. So this is part of the show where we share interesting things that we've encountered online or offline. Richard, am I putting you on the spot? Do you have anything?
Well, you are putting me on the spot, but that's okay. I can handle life on the spot. I'm far from the only person who noticed this, but you know, that's sometimes the way. It's the the blog itself as a URL is zephoria.org also known as Apophenia, and it is on the topic of Twitter, and it was in reaction to a study that noted that 40% of tweets coded by this particular company, Payer Analytics, were pointless babble, 37% conversational, 9% pass-along value, 6% self-promotional, 3.75% spam, and 3.6% news. And the writer, I have to quote it here. I challenge each and every one of you to record every utterance that comes out of your mouth, and that of everyone you interact with for an entire day, et cetera, et cetera. You will most likely find what communication scholars found long ago: people are social creatures, and a lot of what they express is phatic communication, i.e., hi or thank you. And I think this was originally pointed out to me on Twitter by Hugh McGuire of Book Oven, although it may have been simultaneous with someone else pointing it out. And the way Hugh sort of observed it is that basically no one ever accuses the mouth of issuing a lot of pointless babble, even though the mouth issues lots of pointless babble. In fact, I may even be doing so right now. But that Twitter is nothing more than a tool, and that this ongoing dilemma we've got in relation to social media, in relation even to electronic publishing, is always this relentless process of people attributing values to tools when tools are really just something that human beings use and have always used to communicate. So it's a particularly lovely example of that particular idiocy that goes on of over attributing meaning to tools.
Oh, this is Dana Boyd. I know Dana Boyd is
yes,
awesome.
Dana Boyd, exactly.
Yeah. So she's with Microsoft now. I didn't recognize it when you said
she is. She is. You know, and we won't hold that against
that
her.
Yeah, she's been with Microsoft for a while. She's the good Microsoft employee.
Well, I didn't recognize the URL at first, but I guess maybe when she finished her PhD last year, she got hired. Or poached by Microsoft.
Yeah, they opened up a research center here. The name is the North. I think it's Northeast Research and Development Center. So if you want to run that acronym together, you'll get an interesting result.
Wait, sorry.
The Northeast Research and Development. So the Nerd Center.
Okay. Okay, that's where it came from.
Sorry. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. And is she related to Stoboid at all? Do you know Stoboy?
That's a good question.
Anyway,
I never thought of that.
Anyway, Cassia, do you have anything this week?
I mentioned it earlier, and I am overly fascinated by conversion stories, I guess is the best way to put it. So Nathan Bransford, literary agent, he's with Curtis Brown, wrote an article, a funny thing happened on the way to the Kindle, and he's talking about his experience on reading on the iPhone. And I think what fascinates me about these kind of stories is people are thinking that they're not going to have a good time, and then they go, oh, wow, that was really kind of fun. That was pleasant. And, you know, maybe I can add something new to my reading mix. And then I also have a very fun link because, you know, it's not all – and it's from the Harper Studio blog, theharperstudio.com, and it's called Happy Friday Book Lovers, and it is just book porn, print book porn of all kinds, and if you're into that kind of thing, check it out.
Well, the New York Times, the New Yorker essay on the Kindle was much like Bradford's response, right? Like the author started off saying, I'm not going to like this. I'm not going to like this. And then by the end, he's like, I'm totally in. I've been won over, right?
And he was buying books by friends of mine, which made me really happy.
If I may add to this, I read in 6 hours pre-OS 2. This is back when your reading basically involved little workarounds that allowed you to convert HTML to a single scrollable file. Convert a Word doc to HTML, I mean. Single scrollable file I read in 6 hours, 7 a.m., 7 p.m. to 1 a.m. the night before Thanksgiving of 2007. It was a wonderful experience.
The Stanza desktop allows you to do that now. I've thrown a bunch of things I've thrown Word documents and websites onto my iPhone using the Stanza desktop in much the same way. It just gives you a scrollable window. It's really awesome. Who wants to go next? Kirk?
Sure. Mine has a little bit of a backstory. The revelation from Penguin that Thomas Pynchon did in fact narrate the book trailer for Inherent Vice, which in itself is phenomenal. His first book was published 47 years ago, and in his entire career he's never done one thing to promote one of his novels. And here he is on YouTube narrating a book trailer. I almost said book trailer. But how it came about was sort of interesting. The Wall Street Journal Speakeasy blog was curious about whether or not it was Pynchon, and they were getting the typical no-comment response from Penguin publicity. And so they hired a voice analyst to analyze the voice on the new book trailer video and compare it to two other videos. One of them was Pynchon's appearance on The Simpsons, and the third one was a video that apparently was on some sort of German television show about Pynchon's acceptance speech at the 1973 National Book Award, where Pynchon didn't actually accept the award in 1973. He sent Professor Irwin Corey to accept the award. And the voice expert that the Wall Street Journal hired determined that the voice on all three videos was absolutely the same person. And so, armed with this conclusive evidence, the Wall Street Journal went back to the Penguin publicist and said, "Hey, we've got this evidence that this is Thomas Pynchon." And she said, "Okay, you got us. It really is Thomas Pynchon." But in fact, the voice on one of those videos absolutely wasn't Thomas Pynchon, because if you look at the video on YouTube, it's clearly Professor Irwin Corey. So we don't know. Was that Irwin Corey narrating the new Thomas Pynchon book trailer, or was that Thomas Pynchon? But it was an excellent piece of reporting by the Wall Street Journal, and you kind of wonder who they hired to do the voice analysis.
Andrew?
That was funny.
Sure. So for me, because it wouldn't be hearing from me without talking about mobile, was some research that was put out by the European Information Technology Observatory that by the end of this year, more than 4 billion people will be using mobile phones worldwide, which is, you know, 2/3 of the planet basically will be using mobile phones. And you know, on the one hand, that is, of course, an opportunity for someone who's a publisher. But I think the larger picture is that it really suggests that you know, we as a species are going to be more connected, you know, to each other and to the greater world in a way that we've just never been able to imagine before over the next months and years. And I think it's really exciting. And I just am ecstatic to be experiencing it. So
you're on the cusp of the wave.
Very optimistic statistic.
If I were to put that in the show notes, where would I find it?
Yes, that is at, I guess I should just send you the link, huh? It's published off of EITO.com,
okay.
But I'll send you a direct link.
I can Google it and probably find it then. I wanted to point to The 11 Axioms of 21st Century Publishing by Mike Kane at ebooktest.blogspot.com. Kirk, I think I see your name here in the comments. Kane's list.
That's not me. I did read it. I didn't comment.
Oh, okay, maybe.
I know where you're going with this.
No, Kane's list is, you know, concise and provocative.
I think so.
At number six, he says, a book's deep metadata is worth more than the book itself. At number three, he says, connections between books add value to all books. So, I wasn't going anywhere nefarious. I was just saying that that's worth checking out. It's ebooktest.blogspot.com. So I think that's about it for today. For links and show notes, check out pubcall.com. If you have any feedback on this discussion, leave a comment or send an email to feedback@pubcall.com. On behalf of Cassia, the missing cat, Richard, Kirk, and Andrew, this is Mark Bertels, and thanks for listening.